relinquishing power as head of the Zimbabwe service. And you were recently in Harare, Dimi Mwakalielie. How did you find post-Mugabe Zimbabwe, and how is Mnangagwa faring so far?
Thank you for having me on your show. Yeah, yes. Well, when I went to Zimbabwe, there was obviously this atmosphere of euphoria. People were really excited that there was this seeming change in the country. Of course, it's still also very relevant for many to remember that Mnangagwa, though new to the presidency and of course the first person to maybe succeed President Mugabe, is part of the fabric of the old cloth, really, because he was the vice president, and of course as a result of the coup, which some also describe as a non-coup, more as a military intervention, he was kicked out as vice president. He came back, obviously, with the help of the military, and then had the inauguration. So there was a lot of excitement, jubilation, because President Mugabe had been there 38 years, and there was this push for change. Why? Because the economy was really struggling, and people were starting to feel this sense of, you know, just malaise. Things were not really moving, and they just felt that maybe it was a question of President Mugabe. So the expectation now with Mnangagwa coming in, especially now we're around the festive period and around the festive time, there seems to be still a lot of reservation about what he's actually been able to achieve. Of course, this comes also in the backdrop of the commission of inquiry that that followed the post-election violence. And some people looked at that as a progressive effort on his part to try to really get to the bottom of what happened, who killed those six people and injured the 35, and also his commitment to peace in the country. But then there's also the outstanding issues of what happened Gukurahundi. You know, why not a commission about that? Of course, those are the 80s killings. So in the backdrop of all these commissions, there's still this question about, is he really addressing the issue of human rights? To what Mr. Mengesha said about opening up media and business, you know, his mantra has been Zimbabwe is open for business, which got a lot of people excited, and he got into a lot of conversations, especially with international media, not so much local. And unfortunately, even for us, as the Zimbabwe service, have not been privileged yet to interview him. But he's really been declaring that Zimbabwe is open for business, including the media. As the Zimbabwe service, for the first time, we were able to actually go to Zimbabwe, get press credentials, and work from Zimbabwe, of course, with the support of the management, Mr. Mengesha, and able to cover the post-Mugabe situation in November 17, and then reporting the actual elections July, and then just recently managed to hold several town halls, six to be exact, in addition to roundtable discussions as accredited and credentialed VOA reporters, which was not happening during our time under Mugabe.
One of the most drastic moves the Prime Minister took was in June to announce this peace gesture with Eritrea, where he invited actually the Eritrean president for a peace solution of the problem, actually ignoring all protocols. No mediation, no international organization was involved. Single-handedly, he stretched his peace hand, and the Isaias responded positively. So both head of states actually visited both countries. That was an enormous achievement. And also, by the way, not only that, it really went also to attract Djibouti,
overflowing
Somalia,
yes,
and also Eritrea and Ethiopia also to have this regional cooperation. It's really unseen before. Mm-hmm. Really, there's a lot of hope. The other thing is also the step has taken also, he has arrested over 70 former officials, actually charged of corruption and also human rights violation. That's a very, very important step, I think.
So change will not be easy. We have to agree on that, that reforms come at a price.
Definitely at a price. And I must say that it's not all roses, because obviously he does have a lot of challenge from the opposition. Nelson Chamisa of the MDC has been challenging his legitimacy and has been managing to really get a lot of, just movement in the ground in terms
of... That's where my question will come. Meaning that will there now be a temptation from both leaders to deal with their enemies by declaring a state of emergency or to arrest indiscriminately or to use the violence to justify a return to the old school autocracy, which has long been a hallmark of both states. And by doing so, undoing any good work they've been doing. Your thoughts?
In the Ethiopian case, yes, there are challenges. It will be really not wise to ignore them, actually. There are a number of challenges, and which the Prime Minister, by the way, accepts also. There are who are opposed to this reform, and I think there are some alleged sabotage trying to, in the name of the Constitution, trying to stifle this movement. And I think he's determined. He says, we're going to implement our reform. In fact, he's preparing also for the 2022 election, actually. I could see that coming. He said that's not going to be postponed because he wants to have legitimacy for his government. I think he's allowed. He thinks it's going to be free, fair, and transparent election. There's no doubt about that. There is also this ethnic-based federalism actually is creating problems, unresolved problems between the Amhara region and Tigray region regarding Wolkite and also Salamt and other regions also. You could also sporadic ethnic clashes between the Somalis and Oromos in some areas between Benishangul and Amharas, Benishangul and Oromos. You could see that. That's a really big problem. I think the Prime Minister also decisive. He takes swift move to solve these issues. Hopefully this will be under control. But these are really, really big issues that's challenging the new Prime Minister. The other big issue, I would say also, like time bomb, is unemployed youth. The country, like any other African country, is really between age 14 and 32, they are all close to 70%. So that unemployed youth really should have been really neglected for many years, should really get employment. That's a very challenging task on the plate of the Prime Minister, I would say.
Well, definitely in Zimbabwe, as I was mentioning earlier, President Mnangagwa is facing the challenge of legitimacy. And the opposition is really making sure that that is the one sticking point that they keep raising. And it's a situation that he does have to resolve, according to many experts and analysts who are looking into this situation. The opposition is clearly very powerful. They have a very, very strong following. And unless and until there is some kind of an agreement, understanding, conversation at least, dialogue. Many feel that there will be a lot that a government of President Mnangagwa will not be able to achieve. When it comes to the issue of security, there's still a lot of concern about the presence of military, not only in his government, but just in general. Of course, you know that one of the vice presidents is the former defense secretary and defense minister. And obviously, or rather I should say, the commander of the army, Constantino Chiwenga. And obviously also, say, in the areas of the Ministry of Land, it is the former air marshal, Perence Shiri. So there's still a lot of concern that there's a lot of military involvement in his administration. Of course, there's a lot of very unsubstantiated reports about the power struggle within. And then also there is still this big sticking point about trying to also mend fences with President Mugabe and whatever is considered his cabal or the people who were loyal to President Mugabe. So they still, even though within his new cabinet, he does have several, I think about four, who are carryovers from the Mugabe era, including the defense minister, Opa Muchinguri Kashiri. She's from President Mugabe's government. But then also you have a lot of others who are still on the run. You have, of course, the former Minister of Education, Jonathan Moyo, very, very well known. He's not in the country. And, of course, until the likes of Jonathan Moyo come back to Zimbabwe and maybe reestablish themselves as members of the society and work independently, some feel that there's still this element of, you know, disunity and also this ongoing feud between, you know, what was the source of, the complete breakup, this issue of factionalism within the government, where there was the G40 that was involved with President Mugabe and his wife, First Lady Grace Mugabe, and then, of course, Lacoste, which is where President Mnangagwa was affiliated.
I think one advantage I see in the Ethiopian Prime Minister's case, Prime Minister Abiy, contrary to Mnangagwa, he's not in his 70s, he's 42 years young, and he can address the youth. He knows how to speak to the young. Actually, he has that advantage. Plus, also, I mean, he's Amhara, he's an Oromo, a Muslim, Christian. I mean, that combination helps him also to be ready to talk in the name of Ethiopia. And he has become a sort of a figure that's united the country that has been divided for several years. That's a very positive thing, I think.
But that's what worries me, is to actually put the fate of a whole country in one person.
I hope not, to be honest. That's not the way when I spoke with him, that's not the way he thinks, to be honest. He strongly believes he has to establish a strong democratic institutions. That's why he's really diversifying his cabinet also. And he also believes that the army and the security should not be part of the government to control people. They should really keep security and the border of the country also. That's very important. He is keen in respecting human rights. That's extremely important. He is keen in allowing other oppositions, whatever form they are organized, as long as they are participating peacefully, to allow them participating peacefully. And he's really very much determined on that also. In terms of, you know, yeah, I think he understands. By the way, I have never seen a leader in Ethiopia. I've seen, I think, Emperor Haile Selassie, Mengistu, the late Mele Zenawi, Haile Mariam. I have never seen a head of state who is so much loved by many, according to what I have assessed, even among my own kin, relatives, friends in the city. Also, he's really extremely admired and also appreciated what he's doing.
A new era dawning in Africa, changes in the horizon. Dimi Moakalielie, thank you very much. Mr. Nguse Mangesha, Chief of the Africa Division, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome and thank you.
Happy New Year.
Two outbreaks of Ebola in the DRC this year provided a look at the extremes of fighting the deadly disease. One in a remote part of the country's northwest provided hope as a vaccine helped aid workers contain the outbreak fairly quickly. The other in the conflict-plagued east is 5 months old, and experts say it likely will require another 6 months to end because of what they call a perfect storm of complications. In addition to being exposed to a disease that most patients still fail to survive, despite the vaccine and new treatment drugs, doctors and nurses faced daily risk from dozens of armed groups and resistance from local communities that had never heard of Ebola. But as painful as these lessons there have been, they also have provided guidance for the inevitable next outbreak. My colleague Paul Alexander spoke with Dr. Mike Ryan, a member of the World Health Organization's advisory group on Ebola.
Certainly this latest outbreak centered in North Kivu and Ituri has been tough. It's presented many unique challenges to containing an outbreak of Ebola, and not least of which is the security context, the active conflict, a very traumatized and highly mobile population with large urban centers, very close to international borders. So in many ways, a perfect storm, a deep-seated community resistance, or a difficulty of acceptance in communities for the intervention, mainly, you know, driven by frustrations with the situation that the community find themselves in after years of conflict and lack of services. And it has been further complicated by significant transmission within the healthcare system. As we come to the end of the year, we've had qualified successes in containing the disease in North Kivu and Ituri. I think the vaccine has been instrumental in containing the disease. We've managed to keep the disease within the provinces, but we have to deepen the response in those areas that are currently affected and currently have transmission, and we have to broaden our response into areas that are currently unaffected and really move to a much more active response operation in those areas.
So there clearly was a mixture of relief, satisfaction, and hope in overcoming the first outbreak relatively quickly. How has that changed with the frustration of dealing with this second outbreak?
Well, the one thing you can't do in a difficult outbreak is get frustrated. You have to recognize the realities. You have to surface the problems. You have to be very, very honest with yourself and with others around what's working, around what's not. You certainly can't start to blame the community or start to become someone who identifies problems but doesn't find solutions. So the difficult part in any challenging outbreak is to remain focused and work through the issues, get the issues on the table, identify your weaknesses, double down, move again, innovate, adapt, and not just keep doing the same things and expecting a different result. The strategy is good, but implementing the different pillars of the strategy requires us to be very agile, very flexible, very adaptive, and be very innovative in how we approach it. So it is tough after so many months for the teams in the field, and, you know, I take my hat off to them further effort and further resilience and further continued desire to move forward. And it can be tough to get up every day and face the same situation. But I think we are looking really hard at where we can improve and really been extremely transparent about the challenges we face.
So as difficult as this North Kivu outbreak has been, do you feel that in some ways that it prepares you for the future outbreaks to come?
Yes, there's no question. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But yes, we have to learn these lessons. We have to get better. And we are getting better. And the scale of the response in North Kivu has been a hugely effective, coordinated response in the field. There's no question that vaccination is a huge innovation. It's really helping us. There's no question that the standard of care within the treatment units for Ebola has increased. These are no longer isolation units where people go to live or die. These are units now where we can provide a much higher standard of care. And we need to finish the job. We need to get ahead of the virus. And that's going to require another big push. I'm very confident that if we do that, if we keep working hard, if we keep asking ourselves the tough questions, we'll win.
That was WHO's Mike Ryan speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander.
While the international coalition has managed to significantly erode the Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq, there has been an expansion of the Salafi jihadi movement, whether Al-Qaeda or IS, in Africa. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton noted in his address, defining a new Africa strategy, that any sound U.S. strategy must address this threat in a comprehensive way. Emily Estelle is senior analyst at the Critical Threats Project of the American Enterprise Institute. She explained to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi that counterterrorism measures are not sufficient to tackle the expansion of extremist groups in the Sahel.
Defeating a Salafi jihadi group by seizing territory is not actually defeating it. So looking at the Salafi jihadi movement broadly, even as groups have lost terrain in Iraq and Syria, they've expanded around the world, in Africa in particular, the conditions that allow this are poor governance, conflicts, and instability. Essentially cases where populations, in this case Sunni Muslim populations, are vulnerable and can't defend themselves. So then you see either a Salafi jihadi group able to forcibly take control of the population, looking at the case of ISIS in Sirte in Libya, for example, or you see Salafi jihadi groups essentially outcompeting the state or other local rivals to become the defenders of a population that's otherwise vulnerable to conflict or has no other alternative.
So far, the international response has been confined to counter-terrorism measures such as the G5 Sahel Joint Force located in Mali. What should be added to eradicate violent extremist groups from Africa?
The U.S. and the international community needs to look beyond a purely military counterterrorism strategy, because the actual issue at hand is the conditions that allow Salafi jihadi groups to operate and the larger issue of outcompeting the Salafi jihadi movement for the support of populations. So that means that along with the need to actually fight these groups, which is a real need, the requirement is to change the conditions, and that will vary depending on the location. So, for example, in Libya, the requirement is actually to end the civil war, because the civil war and the breakdown of the government has been what's allowed space for ISIS, for Al-Qaeda to operate. That will vary by country. Sometimes there's a conflict resolution requirement or a capacity building, governance building requirement, helping with conflict resolution mechanisms, judiciaries, et cetera. The programs will vary by place, but there needs to be a combination of changing these local dynamics as well as militarily weakening the group.
President Donald Trump said earlier this year that the U.S. should not have any role in Libya beyond counterterrorism. How did that strategy affect the efforts to prevent Libya from being a safe haven for terrorist groups?
President Trump's comment actually reflected the way that policy in Libya was already being run, so it didn't cause a particular change, but it does get after the issue in that the U.S. has defined counterterrorism in Libya narrowly to mean attacking predominantly ISIS, occasionally al-Qaeda, while at the same time trying to contain the instability from Libya and kind of advance towards some stability. The problem there is that it's impossible to actually complete the counterterrorism mission in Libya without ending the conflict. So the main effort should actually be working to end the civil war, which requires a high-level diplomatic push, as well as the programming required to strengthen governance in Libya. And the U.S. has been engaged on some productive tracks, including working on Libya's economic issues and also from the perspective of aid. The U.S. has been a leader in both of those things. But what's absent in the Libya file is any international leadership to actually end that conflict at the top so that all of these initiatives can come through and stabilize the country.
So what role do you envision for the U.S. in particular to face the threat of violent extremist groups to African security?
I think that the role that the U.S. should play regarding counterterrorism in Africa is actually aligned with the role that the U.S. now seems interested in playing vis-a-vis competing with Russia and China. So National Security Advisor Bolton is announcing a new strategy, and I think there's actually synergy in that the U.S. needs to be engaged in Africa diplomatically, economically, on security, and be a strong partner with African states, which is something that has been missing under this administration. And at the same time as competing with other global powers, it also gives the U.S. the opportunity to partner and build up local security forces to identify the places where communities are vulnerable to Salafi jihadi groups. So that overall mission of engagement is actually what will set the stage for then dealing with the localized problems as they appear.
That was Emily Estelle, senior analyst at Critical Threats Project of the American Enterprise Institute. She spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this special pre-recorded edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.